Hello and welcome to the podcast. Today I'm going to talk you through what it feels like when you sell your house to buy more Bitcoin. 3 years ago, my wife and I made a big decision. It's like, oh, hang on a second. So here's the fastest horse in the race from an asset potential, from a capital growth potential. Let's go and rent another house in a nicer neighborhood and we can pick up some more Bitcoin along the way. Let's sell our house. What I'm going to do in this episode is run through the good, the bad, and the ugly of what this meant. And 3 years has now gone by. And it's going to be a slightly different format to anyone that's listened to the podcast in the past. So bear with me as I try this kind of for the first time. And hopefully there'll be some helpful graphics and definitions and stuff that we pop up alongside me as I go through this. Frankly, part of this process has been absolutely brilliant. And that's been the financial aspect. So selling real estate and buying Bitcoin in 2022 has proved to be an excellent decision. And in the world of investment, it's called a five bagger. So five times more value. That's extraordinary. When you think that, you know, the S&P 500 or any other index is returning, what, 7, 10, 15% per year. You look at the fixed income market of maybe only a couple of percent points. The actual net yield on real estate itself, even when leveraged, sub 10%, five times your money. I mean, it's like a whole nother world. Now, the cool bit of Bitcoin, of course, and I've discussed this many times in the past, is it's the risk reward. The risk is actually nowhere near what people think it is. And so the reward is massive, but also what are you risking? Owning something that's digital, in self-custody, no one can debase it on the back end. I mean, what an incredible tool. And because of the very nature of it being so early in its adoption, you're getting this incredible capital growth for what is essentially just a savings technology. Now, the flip side of this is renting a house that's nicer in a nicer neighborhood has created all sorts of problems for my wife and I, and I'm going to run those through you today. And basically what's happened is, according to my strategy and the price target that I set and the timeline that I had in mind, 3 years has gone by, we've hit August 2025, we're over the price target of 150K Aussie dollars that I set for that moment. And so maybe it's time to take some profits. And in the world of Bitcoin, this can be seen as, oh my God, don't sell your Bitcoin. For me, at this stage in my life, the ability to sell Bitcoin outweighs the cost. And that is being completely independent, working for myself, giving my wife and my kids a great lifestyle. But there's one key area that's been missing, which is physical real estate. Going completely digital has its difficulties. So you're going to learn what's worked, what hasn't worked. And the process that I'm now developing to actually due diligence physical real estate as a purchase and try and find us a property to have as a base. Finally, you know, why listen to me? Well, I've been investing my own money for over 10 years now. I do believe that your biggest losses are your biggest lesson. My biggest loss was in physical real estate. So what have I learned from that? Hopefully that will come through in this episode. And I like sharing stuff that I figure out along the way so that you don't lose money as well. Like, I've got it wrong many times. And by doing this podcast and investigating the way that I do, speaking to the people that come on the show, that's the point, right? Is do more that these people do and do less of what I've done many times before. So moving into like the nuts and bolts of this episode, you know, why would you even think about owning Bitcoin instead of real estate? Well, it's quite simple, right? What is your purchasing power? So have you calculated your net assets? Have you figured out, you know, assets versus liabilities? Have you looked at what your running costs are, your burn rate, the amount of disposable income that you require each month? How long does your savings stack last for when compared to your costs? Very, very simple kind of wealth management questions that need to be put in mind. And basically, if you're not tracking purchasing power, you're not actually measuring your own wealth. And that's where you get these incredible things where, for example, if you price the S&P 500 in gold, it hasn't gone up. If you want to buy a fine gentleman's suit on Savile Row, it costs you the same amount of gold today as it would have done for a Roman legionary to be a well-dressed gent of Rome. Like, that's crazy. And that's because gold is sound money. And gold is a way of measuring value as well as what we've all been conditioned to think about, which is fiat currencies, the pounds, the euros, the RMB, the US dollar. And when I rewind to, you know, 2021, 2022, I'd owned some Bitcoin for some time. 2015, when I first bought some, I'd sold a bunch along the way, but it was very clearly my best performing asset. is this something that you want to double down on? And my research was just an absolutely like roaring yes. Like, yes, you want to own more of this stuff. And so why do I own what I own? It began this process of looking at the assets I was in control of, like how does it compare to Bitcoin? And basically everything sucked in comparison to Bitcoin. It's like you want as much Bitcoin as you can get your hands on. It's like, okay, cool. What does that mean? And in my case, it's like, well, actually, hang on. What's this real estate that I own? Okay, and we had some problems with the house that we were in. And I won't go into all the details of why, but long story short, my wife and I, driven by me entirely, you know, this is a better bet for us financially long term. Let's do it. She jumped on for the ride, and what an amazing partner in life Loz is. So shout out to her for even willing to take that risk and to back my conviction in a sense. But it's like, what's the fastest horse in the race when it comes to capital protection and capital growth combined with what's the risk? And Bitcoin just, it just wins on all of these kind of like metrics. But the flip side of it is you can't live in a Bitcoin. It's super simple. Yes, it's a digital money that you can take anywhere in your head. That's incredible. But physical shelter is something that it doesn't give you. And so, you know, believe it or not, like since we actually sold that previous house in 2022, we've had two more children. So we have three kids, basically five and younger. And I calculated we have moved 15 times in 3 years. Now, that includes a shift from, you know, basically within Melbourne. And then Melbourne, we moved up to Byron Bay for a bit. And then we went on a couple of holidays. And then, you know, now we're back in Melbourne and looking here. 15 times I've had to pack suitcases, figure out what are we taking with us? What's going into storage? What do we not need? And it is absolutely exhausting. So on the one hand, you've had extraordinary financial success from the decision we made. You know, five times your money with a very low risk profile. That is unbelievable. If you can find me a better performance than that anywhere else, let me know. It's one of the reasons why I'm such a big Bitcoin advocate, right? Is you see your purchasing power surge over this three-year period. It opens up other opportunities. You know, okay, cool. Well, this is interesting, but what it's highlighted next is this reality of, okay, let's just rent. Well, you're then basically someone else controls your space. A landlord of some form or an Airbnb, short-term rental, whatever it might be. And it made me realize that when you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, food and shelter at the very bottom, right? Well, what selling your house and buying Bitcoin means is you're back in that first stage again at least once a year. So if you sign a 12-month contract, the contract's coming to an end, the landlord doesn't want to renew it, well, what do? You've got to find shelter again. And in our case, we've done that 15 times. And for whatever reason, we've had tons of lessons crop up from the properties that we've lived in. And I'll get onto that later. But it's so interesting, isn't it? When you're figuring out shelter, you know, I feel like I'm, you know, the phrase that, you know, often a business owner wants to be working on their business rather than in their business. It's like I've been working in my family rather than on my family because of this need to constantly figure out, like, where are we going to be in a couple of weeks' time? The rental market's been interesting. It's very, very expensive. It opens up the discussion on migration here to Australia. There's a lack of supply and the quality is just really pretty poor. And so what's happened is it's like, okay, 3 years has gone by. We've kicked the targets that we set as a financial return and we're just completely over this process of living out of suitcases. And we want to reallocate some of our, you know, increased purchasing power back into physical real estate. And what I want to run you through here is the process that I'm building to look for an appropriate property. And something I really feel strongly about is, you know, when the information changes, so should you. I.e., when you learn new things, if you haven't reconsidered what your previous lens on the world was, then is that intelligence? And there's a number of different examples of this. I'm not going to go into that now, but what I'm trying to do is build a due diligence process for a physical real estate purchase that removes the emotion and also increases the ability to make a really great investment that covers not just financial returns, but also the wider picture of the humanistic capital that I'm managing and also the intellectual capital. So what can I learn on the way through? What might be something I want in the future, but also like, how do I continue to foster my humanistic capital, make sure my kids have a good life, give them somewhere to be stable from? And so it throws up tons of different things. In some ways, I've made the process of finding myself a property incredibly difficult, because to actually tick all the boxes is really, really, really hard. Anyway, let me keep going. So obviously, on a high level, when you're looking for a house, it's like, what kind of house do you want? So how many bedrooms, how many bathrooms? In our case, we're very, very specific about wanting to have a north-facing backyard, you know, with a combined kitchen living area and grass. We really want grass. So many of these properties we look at, they have fake grass everywhere. It's like, no, I want to be able to touch the earth in my backyard. You want to have it on a nice quiet street, perhaps. We definitely want to have a second living space. So, you know, with three young kids, their stuff just explodes everywhere. And if you're in one kitchen, living, sitting, dining area, it drives you nuts. So you need to have a second area for them to hang out in. I'd also love a garage, like as simple as that sounds, a covered space for cars and all the other stuff that you pick up as a young family. Now, of course, price is important. Like as an allocation, you know, what do I own? What's an appropriate percentage of my net assets to spend on physical real estate? Can you get leverage? Can you not get leverage? What kind of leverage can you actually get? I'll come to that later as I run through these. And I then sat down and I wrote out a vision. It's called the Melbourne, the city pad. And I described how it would feel. I described the specific features I was looking for. And that was my starting point. And so I'm trawling through realestate.com.au looking for different properties. And I'd find one that looked about right. And then I'm going, okay, where's the north? Okay, what's the aspect of the backyard? What's the floor plan? And loads of really interesting stuff would come out of that. And quite quickly, you're like, nope. And then it's like, okay, let's bring some added layers of sophistication in, which previously I didn't have this. So first of all, shout out to Janine. And I'll link all of these characters' web details in the show notes. So Janine is a intuitive healer. I had her on the podcast earlier this year. Go back and listen to the episode with her to get a better feel for what she's up to. But Loz and I have a relationship with her where we can send her like life decision points, and she will feel into the energy, she'll do the astrology work that she loves and tune into like, oh, is this a good idea? Is it a bad idea? And we've then morphed into like, okay, is this the right house? Is this the right house? Is this the right house? It was incredible what she was able to pick up on. For example, one property that we looked at, she's like, it's great for right now, but in the same way that you might buy a shoe for a child that's slightly too big, this one fits perfectly right now, but quite soon won't be quite right. Yeah, great point. And so there's no point sharing like ultra specifics necessarily, but Janine was a great sounding board. So, okay, this is one we're looking at. She'd come up with like four or five things that were good, four or five things that we should reconsider. Moving on, Jason, shout out to Jason Parks. Jason and I have been having lots of conversations about energetics over the last year as my kind of energetics mentor. And in particular, he's very interesting with properties when it comes to feng shui. And this is an area of sophistication that wasn't even available to me in the past. But some of the things that came out of it for me are like, you know, you want to be looking at like, where is there water on the property? Where is there like plants and foliage, for example? A house has a face. When you look at that face, what does it feel like? Does it seem to be welcoming? And then the aspect of the property, like very, very important. We looked at a place that had the most incredible view of Byron Bay, but just off the back of the property was a main road. And he described the energy coming whooshing in through the driveway and through the front door of the house and straight off the balcony and down this extraordinarily steep slope. And he's like, that house would be like living at the top of an energetic waterfall, and it would just drag you off the top the whole time. And it hadn't been on the market for 30, 40 years. And he's like, that's very stagnant. You could see that the jungle below was completely overgrown. It's like, that's a classic example of a property that's energy. It's very, very difficult to harness. And it was also in a triangular shape. And I started learning about the fact that when it comes to feng shui, for stability, you want a square block or a rectangular block with proper corners. As soon as there's a corner missing, or it's in like an odd kind of triangular shape, it can be very bad for relationships, very bad for wealth, very bad for health. You're like, okay, now obviously pinch of salt with all these things, but you start to build a bigger picture. It's like now when I'm looking at properties, when I check that floor plan, I'm like, what's the size of the block? Is it a nice square rectangular block? Can it keep the energy nice and stable for my family? And where this is ultimately all going is like what we want and what we need is a healthy home. And again, an area of life that wasn't even on my radar before the last 3 years of renting lots of different properties was the side effects of certain issues with properties on people's health. Like, our houses are making us sick. It's quite incredible. So not just from an energetics perspective, like what I've just described, but now I'll go into some more detail on some other more like rigorous kind of scientific approaches in a sense. So first of all, Zahir, shout out to him. He came into something, his business called Site Inspection. Look it up. It was the most incredible report, 400 pages of issues with a property that I'm currently negotiating on. And what I learned from this is, like, if you do a building inspection, if the sales agent recommends a building inspector that they like, remember that the incentive is not for the building inspector to do a great job for your property purchase. It's for the inspector to do a good enough job such that the agent continues to recommend them for more business, because it's likely that you only need them once. And so the agent will recommend their buddy, goes and does a rough little tick box thing, has a look around. There's $800. Thanks very much. Yeah, it's a great house. Go for it. Whereas here, it's like, hang on, he did a 400-page report. It cost me four times the amount of money. But he's going around and is actually looking for damage in a way that other inspectors weren't willing to do. And so you build a very, very complex and deep picture of like the state of this building. And some of the things that came out of it was like literally 40 non-compliant problems with this house I was looking at that the building regulator today would call out a builder on and be like, that's non-compliant, that's non-compliant, that's non-compliant. Found some issues with the joists in the roof that were kind of pulling apart, like proper structural stuff. The main thing with him and actually all these experts I'm going to run you through is like, find me a red flag with this property that means it's structurally, you know, completely fucked and cannot be repaired. And therefore, you're not buying something that's a massive problem. If you're buying something that requires some money to be spent on it, that's okay, as long as the price you buy it at reflects that, right? Because you don't want to go and overcapitalize on one of these things because perhaps you want to sell it and suddenly it's like, well, it's not worth the money you've actually spent all in. Oh, now you're sitting on a nice big loss. That's actually exactly what happened to me back in London with an apartment that, two apartments actually, that I got stung so badly on. The biggest lesson as an investor I've ever had. So yeah, use the site inspector if you're in Melbourne for any future kind of due diligence on a property. Now moving on, EMF. So a lot of people don't pay any attention to this whatsoever, but shout out to Patrick who came and did a consultation at two different properties. And the first one, he picked up on something that was literally like, this is a red flag, I wouldn't buy this house. And what he did is he's got three different types of EMF he's looking at. So magnetic, electric, and radio frequency. And he's got different tools for picking up on all of them, and they come from different places. But for example, if you're on a street with the power lines on the same side of the street as you, those power lines are giving off an electromagnetic field that, if you're not careful, can be a big problem. For example, in a property we lived in Byron Bay, the front bedrooms were within such a distance of the power cables on the street that when you were sleeping at nighttime, those power lines were basically, they were affecting whoever was sleeping in that bed. And the upshot of this is a sustained period of exposure to this kind of thing leads to inflammation. Inflammation leads to disease. So if you're lying in bed at night and you've got a power line just outside your bedroom, you're basically slowly cooking yourself. And it's really bad for you. Anyway, in this property, he found at one point he turned off all the electrics to the house and there was still a current running through the property. And for that reason, he was like, I would never buy this house. The point being is you'd always be conducting electricity in some way. And he explained what can happen is in suburbs of cities, the grid doesn't do its job in the way that it's designed to. And that electricity needs to find a home and it ends up sitting in the earth and in properties themselves. And so even if you switched off the main switchboard of your house, in this case, you'd still have electricity running through the building. And for him, that was like big red flag. Incidentally, he then went to a second place, which he looked at, didn't have that problem, but he identified a cell tower that was actually visible out of the back bedroom windows. Now, the cool thing here is that's actually totally fixable. So he has a process by which you use a certain paint on the wall, which has graphene in it. You can put a certain type of curtain in and you can put things on the floor. So at nighttime, and the key with these EMFs is that at night, if you're sleeping in a place for 8 hours where you're not getting like battered by EMFs, that's incredibly good for your health versus not. So what you can create is these like bunkers, essentially, in your own home, where you're not getting hit with the cell tower radiation, you're not getting hit with the power line radiation. And the other area, and that for me is, that's awesome, right? You know that you're sleeping in a place that's safe for you from that perspective. Now, the next level that for us, this was just such a big lesson, is we've lived in three properties with mold. And this is one funny moment where my wife is really sick. She's like, it's this fucking house, it's this fucking house. And I said to her, Lauren, it's all in your head. And it was just one of those classic moments as a husband and wife where that was not the right thing to say. And quite rightly so. And a couple of weeks later, we'd had an EMF expert through the property that told us about the power lines at the front. And we also had a mold and moisture report done that showed that we were living in a house that was stuffed full of mold. Now, mold's just natural, right? Sure, it is. But certain types of mold proliferate in wet buildings in a way that they don't just come from the environment outside. Now, in this case, we were living in a two-year-old new build in Byron that didn't smell of mold. You couldn't see the mold, but it was absolutely stuffed with the stuff. And that's because, in our opinion, the builder just carried on building when it was soaking wet. And there were some very bad floods a couple of years ago, 2021, 2022. And in our opinion, we bet that what he did was just carried on building. You're like, fuck. And so now you're sitting in a house that's full of mold. It made us all sick. And we learned about mold. So you do not want to be living in a moldy house. And so now, as part of the due diligence process on a house, not only do I get the building inspector in and get one that's actually on your side, not the agent's, you get the EMF guy to have a look through. You also get a mold and moisture report done. And in this case, first property we looked at, best build they'd ever seen, but it was the one where the EMF guy was like, red flag. Another property we looked at, actually, this property's great. There's a little bit of mold in the roof and there's some rising damps in the wall, but that should be fixable. So shout out to Steph, who helped us, and shout out to Raphael, who's also helped us. And these facts, they begin to build a picture of like, okay, this can be a healthy home for us. We can really feel like this is going to be right. And so when it comes to like, well, what's it going at on the market, you're building yourself a picture which is different to other investors that A, helps you see where there's a lack of value, but B, might help you see whether there's a lot of value that's not necessarily reflected in the price. But this becomes interesting. You see something that others don't, basically. And that is an edge that you're building. And so the top of funnel is like everything on realestate.com, right? And the bottom of the funnel is like, okay, well, there's like two or three houses in this whole part of a particular city that might make sense right now. Now, also just shout out to Tom, who's helped us. Hasn't physically been to any inspections, but he, from his story, I believe, he bought a house and it was a disaster. They had to pull the whole thing to pieces to get rid of all the mold and figure out the EMF. And through that, he's become a consultant. Again, I'll put all of these links in the show notes so you can get in touch with these people if you want. But what's been cool is I've been able to say, hey, Tom, look, here's the mold report. Here's the EMF report. Here's the site inspection report. Can you see a major red flag? If not, then I'm willing to proceed. Next up, I used a evaluator. So thank you, Kate. She went and looked at a property for me, picked up some comparables. You've obviously got to be careful. There are certain types of valuations that are needed. For example, if there's an insurance claim, or maybe you're doing a transfer of an asset between two family members. You need a very, very specific in-depth valuation report. But those same people that can create those can do like, you know, 10% version of, okay, ballpark, I reckon this house is worth X. And the advantage of that being, it's like, I'm a retail investor. I do a few transactions like this my entire life. Where is the market? Am I overpaying? Am I underpaying? What actually makes sense? And that's very helpful because you can suddenly peg a figure and be like, well, above that, you're getting kind of emotional. What are the additional reasons you have for overpaying from that number? And it's like a peg, basically, to be like, okay, well, that's probably about right. Now, obviously, to do a transaction like what I'm looking at here in Australia, the process is a contract of sale. Now, very important to get a good conveyancing lawyer to have a look at it. A shout out to Sophie, who helped me last week with one. And again, because they're experts, right? We spent an hour on the phone, cost me a few $100, absolutely worth it, because out of that came, well, look, this is a really vendor-friendly clause. And it's just helpful because you can go back to the person who's selling this thing and say, look, I can see your terms. Those make lots of sense for you, but I've just found, you know, lots and lots of non-compliant issues with this property, I'm going to have to spend a lot more on it than I originally thought. And you've now got a clause in there that says I can't hold you or the owner liable for any non-compliant stuff. I can handle that, but it's going to be reflected in my price. Next up, I just want to mention from a finance perspective. So Clint's been helping me out. We have been able to figure out a situation where I've got pre-approval on a property up to a certain level. And I was a difficult use case because in my world, I live on the capital gains for the investment decisions I make. And so I don't necessarily have income from an employment contract to take to the mortgage market and say, hey, look, here's my beautiful income. You can give me a loan against that. And therefore, my demonstrative affordability is very good. In my case, I'm like, look, I've got a really healthy balance sheet here. But people are like, oh, I can't lend you any money. Okay, cool. Well, there must be someone that can look past that and see it in a different way. And Clint's helped me find that person. And it's called a capitalized asset lend, I believe. And they're basically saying, look, not just are we getting a loan to value on the property that you buy, whether it's 75% or 60%, i.e. you're putting 25% of your own money into this thing or 40% of your own money into this thing, and they get paid back first if you had to sell. But also, look, here's the asset base that they can sell down from to actually, you know, pay the interest costs. And so you may have seen some of my recent podcasts. I was looking closely at this idea of, like, what's the opportunity cost between owning Bitcoin and owning real estate? And the truth is, owning Bitcoin is much, 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 much better from a capital growth perspective. But you need shelter. Like, I actually need this thing. And that's what the last 3 years has taught me. It's like, Jake, you really made such a big call then, saying, right, we don't have a permanent house that we own. We're going to have lots of young kids and we're going to just move around. It's like, whoa, okay, we're done. That's too much. We need to iterate from that. And the thing that's been interesting is like, okay, well, how do I do that? So, well, I'm willing to sell some Bitcoin to get into real estate again. But real estate's a highly leveraged market with a very well-developed suite of financial tools. If I can take leverage, then I don't have to sell as much Bitcoin. That Bitcoin can continue to do its purchasing power growth in the background. And I now get a house out of it that I have to just pay some interest payments on. Well, that's actually great. That's almost like a hybrid real estate Bitcoin blended investment process. And so I can look at my net assets and go, okay, well, actually, I'm going to put this amount across into real estate and own it outright in cash. But I then have the commitment to carry the interest. If I do that for 4 years, I'm very confident that that net asset allocation, the real estate part of it, will shrink, right? For example, you might put 20% into real estate. Oh, look, Bitcoin doubled in value. Now it's only 10% of my net worth. And I expect that to happen. And next up, I just want to mention as well, shout out to Pete Vaster, who's my accountant here in Melbourne, been helping with this process. And what we've had to do for the pre-approval on the finance is we've actually had to set up a company. So it's a separate entity, and that entity will be the person that takes the debt, or that will be the vehicle that we hold the debt in. So basically, there's different ways of structuring real estate deals. Are you buying it in your own name? Are you buying it as a company? Are you taking leverage? Are you not? How do you do this? Great questions. Everyone's different. So make sure you get, like, you know, your accountant and get them on side. A final shout out in terms of people that have helped is Bianca, my sister-in-law. And we haven't got this far yet, but one property we're looking at will require some work to be done. And therefore, we need some help to redesign the home and do bathrooms and do a swimming pool. And there's obviously things that have been flagged by the assessors that I've sent through that need to be updated as well. And so finding someone who's an interior architect / project manager to help you actually do the things that you figure out, really important as well. And I'll link B's contact below. And so where does this all get you? Like I mentioned, how do I buy a piece of real estate in a way where I know that I'm making a good decision? Well, I've built this due diligence process, and it involves other experts, of course. So it's not just me doing it. But at the end of all of this, it's like, does this property meet the requirements that I've set out? Is there an EMF problem? Is it solvable? Is there a mold and moisture problem? Is it solvable? Is there any structural issues with this property? Is it solvable? Then where's the market at? Is there comparables I can get hold of? Should I be overpaying? Why do I actually want to go and buy this thing? And it's been a hunt for a red flag. And so far, there's one property in particular that I've started negotiating on that hasn't got a red flag. I'm very excited about. Hopefully it will work. But again, I don't want to get emotional. It's like, okay, put a number on it, negotiate, see what you can get back. If it doesn't work out, abundance everywhere, the property that's right for you will appear. And that's then more of a mindset thing, going back to a Jason or a Janine. another helpful thing to do is obviously to go back to the feature set of the property that you wanted and just compare it. Like, here's my vision. Here's the property. What are the major trade-offs? Are they ones I'm willing to make? Yes or no? Some additional points about the market in general is I've been getting a lot of like hype from agents. It's like, oh, interest rates are down. Interest rates are going to come down again. And it's not that I don't think that's wrong directionally. Like, I think that that is probably likely to happen. Around the world, central banks are going to start doing that. And that's very, very healthy from an asset price perspective. Not going to go into the disbenefits of people that are living on cash and how horrible inflationary monetary policy actually is for well-being. But I do think that the real estate markets will bump with that. The question is, are they beating real inflation? And how might that happen? So what's the sentiment of the day? Is it very positive? Is it a buyer's market? Is it a seller's market? Now, what were the actual sales done, right? These agents that sit on top of the owners, they are professional negotiators. I don't want to call them professional bullshitters because they can't be to actually do the business, right? But there's definitely ways of creating fake scarcity. And that is an auction, for example. You know, they want as many emotional buyers going through an auction as possible. On that note, there was a property that sold at auction on the weekend that we looked very closely at, but they refused to do a mold and moisture report for us. So we said, okay, this is not the right house. Very interesting. And one thing to really point out as well, it's become so obvious, not that I necessarily thought about it, but to me, like, why is real estate going up in terms of growth, as they call it? You know, you can ask an agent, in the last 10 years, you've sold that same house four times. Why has it gone up in price? And they'll all point to like physical factors. But to me, it's mainly from the money printing, right? You look at how many dollars the Royal Bank of Australia has created in the last 10 years, and you'll see that it maps very closely to the real estate market. But I do now really see the additional kind of driver for growth in Australia in particular is migration. So I ran some numbers recently, and the amount of people that moved to Australia, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, like, let's assume that those are correct numbers, is the population of Australia grew by 5%. Now, that speed of growth, obviously it's only a small country, 25, 28 million, is as fast as the fastest growing nations of sub-Saharan Africa. So yes, it's a kind of synthetic growth in that they are, you know, grown adults migrating to the country, and that's not a birth rate necessarily. But that means they need more schools, more hospitals, more roads, and more housing. And so the reason that we found the rental market so difficult to find value is because people are absolutely busting their gut to just rent anything. You know, they'll just take it, right? You get these crazy pictures of people queuing up to see tiny apartments in Sydney to rent. And so much of the mechanics of the real estate market wind me up because it is the symptom of money printing, right? Houses have become a form of money. And so with that in mind, it's like, is a real estate investment a bad investment? Well, I'm not making this reallocation to physical real estate for capital growth. And that also puts me in a strong position, right? I'm making this reallocation because I need shelter. And if it comes at a cost, i.e. this house is a liability and I've got to pay interest on it, if I eventually sell it and I make a break even, in some ways, the fact that I've been able to control my physical space, that is worth it alone for me. Now, there are other people out there that would call themselves real estate investors who would like balk at that concept. Like, what do you mean I'm not going to get capital growth out of my real estate? It's like, well, what is the net yield you're getting on that each year? Okay, well, it's getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. Like here in Victoria, for example, the land tax has been put up. So if it's an investor-owned property, they've suddenly got to pay land taxes. Primary places of residence aren't included in that. But that trend is going to continue. Higher tax, higher running costs. So landlords are going to get squeezed. Thankfully for me, it's like, this is not a capital growth play, as I mentioned. So where am I going with all this? Okay, crunch time. You got to put an offer in. Now, this is a process I'm going through only now. Don't obviously put your best number in first. Negotiate on every angle that you can, whether that's size of deposit, whether that's a settlement period that you're willing to do. Are you subject to finance? Yes or no? And just try not to get sucked into the agents that are going to, you know, try and make you as emotional as possible, as quick as possible. Be well researched. Have a little bullet point of list that you want to talk through. Oh, well, I was looking at this other house that has a pool and this one doesn't. Or I was looking at this place that's closer to the school, or this one's closer to the grocery store or the beach or whatever. You know, basically negative reasons to be looking away from this property. And after all of that, like, basically just try to build a process that you take the emotion out. And so hopefully, as I've gone through all of this, you've learned what are the things that I'm looking for in a real estate deal and how my future-proofing myself against a bad decision. And eventually it gets pretty sophisticated. And always come back to this idea of, okay, well, what are my net assets? What do I need? And what is an appropriate allocation to make to something that I need, aka shelter? I would love to say, you know, okay, this isn't about capital growth, but it definitely is about matching the real rate of inflation. So that would be like a very, very base case. If that was done, then I'm okay with that. I'm really excited because I'm learning loads of new things. You're like, oh, this is interesting. And an area that I'm not going to touch on in much detail here, but like, what if you didn't have to sell your Bitcoin? Now, in our case here, it's like, okay, we need shelter. I'm very, very excited to have made 5-6x my money. Enjoy taking some profits, Jake, and spend it on something that you actually need, aka a family home or a base to travel from or whatever it might be, and just anchor yourself with that. It's almost like it's a resource, isn't it? It's something that you can fall back on to use when you need it. I think that's one of the hardest things about being in the rental space, like just never quite knowing where you're going to be. And, you know, yes, okay, fine. The government could turn up on your doorstep tomorrow and the counterparty risk of actually owning these things is very high. They could just take it off you if they wanted. Like COVID made that so clear, right? Melbourne became a police state overnight. And what are you going to do about it? Like you can't. So the key here is obviously like a majority or a predominantly digitally driven, Bitcoin driven wealth strategy. It makes sense to have some anchors in the physical world, but always beware of counterparty risk, right? Bitcoin wins every time, as far as I'm concerned. But equally, you know, okay, if I was to start becoming a real estate investor, what would it look like if I could get leverage against some Bitcoin? That leverage then becomes a deposit, and then you also get leverage against the property itself. And suddenly you have no money down on a piece of physical real estate. How does that match up? I'm going to look into it is the answer. I have yet to find a debt provider that I'm actually happy with. And so it's like, okay, they all want a 40% loan to value ratio, or they want 100% loan to value ratio. You've got to deposit your Bitcoin somewhere else. And that's going up at 40-50% CAGR every year. So I'm very wary of being too cute. And it's like, oh, look, that counterparty's disappeared. And now, your Bitcoin's gone. Or it wasn't actually segregated, even though they said it was. Or the multi-sig, you know, startup that you used didn't work. I'll do another video on that because I think that's a really interesting area to look. And as an investor and an entrepreneur, like this idea that using Bitcoin as your base layer financing tool, it's like, okay, how can I not sell down the Bitcoin equity, but unlock opportunities that I see elsewhere? And that to me is awesome. Anyway, what's the point of a good investment? Well, in some ways, it's like just to improve your life, right? How can owning a property that my family are happy, healthy in not improve my life? Like, just enjoy it, Jake. And that's what I have to remind myself. Like, oh, I don't sell my Bitcoin. But like, no, mate, this is sometimes about more than financial returns. And like I mention quite often is, you know, this idea of humanistic and intellectual capital drive financial returns. And so in this case, it's like, it's a humanistic investment. And I'm happy with that because what my kids and my wife will get out of this investment is so much more than what the physical return of it might be. Let me wrap this up. Like, basically, set a strategy, whatever investment you're making, whether it be, okay, we're going to sell the house to buy Bitcoin, hold the Bitcoin until you say you're going to hold it. You know, for me, that was a 3-year period to August 2025. Stick to it. As the information changes, question your strategy. That's totally okay. So we hit the 150K August 2025 price target. I could find a tweet of mine for sure that, you know, predicted that however long ago. And I've succeeded that. Great. Enjoy it. Be comfortable with taking those profits. But remember, you cannot live in a Bitcoin. And that is the moral of the story here. You might be able to spend Bitcoin to buy things around you that are helpful, but ultimately you don't control your space in a way that you might want to. So with a young family of 3 kids, actually the time is right. Jake, get back into some physical stuff and enjoy that fact. Now, if any of this has been interesting to you, I'd love to hear from you. Reach out hi@jakewoodhouse.io. I'm always keen to learn of different people's decision-making processes. So like, what do you buy? What do you sell? How long do you hold it for? What's actually important to own? And in particular, this real estate stuff. It's like, what's an angle that I'm not aware of that might be useful to consider in the future? Keep an eye out for some more content like this. Hopefully this solo episode has been useful. We're going to try and chuck in some graphics and some definitions through the whole process. And I'm going to go and start looking into, as I mentioned already, like leverage on your Bitcoin and what kind of world that opens up. I'm going to look into actually some stuff that recently happened here with people getting upset about immigration. It's like, well, who's getting upset and why? And I had a good conversation with my friend CJ about this. And basically this idea that immigration is a moral discussion. It's like, why has it been turned into that? And that to me is really interesting. I'm also going to do something on the idea of like hardware versus software. And the kind of conventional wisdom of the last 20 years that I thought was really, really valuable was like software is a better bet than hardware. And the reason is that it's much more scalable. So the marginal cost of production to add an additional user is essentially zero. So once you've built some product market fit and you've got a developer team in place, then you can scale extraordinarily fast. And that's what leads to hockey stick growth and, you know, some of the incredible angel investment returns that we've heard of. And what does it mean in a world in which vibe coding now exists? What does it mean when any person can get bespoke software created for them at a fraction of the price previously, at a fraction of the speed? And essentially, you can problem solve anything that your business comes up against should the solution be software using an AI. So that the moat that a startup previously built itself is disintegrating yet again with the speed of improvement of AI. And so maybe the contrarian insight is actually you want to be going after hardware opportunities in which you can implement software easily as the business owner. And anyway, keep tuned, stay tuned, or whatever you want to say. I'll get into that in the future. Thank you so much for your time today. And fingers crossed I get a house sorted. Thank you.